And welcome to Food Software Roundtable. My name is Kupo.
I'm Ilya.
This is Bill.
And this is Jonathan.
And today,
we're going out of a different setup today. We're actually broadcasting live from Hope.
Yep. So should we dive straight into a little bit about Hope?
What it is and what it's about?
What it is. Yeah,
well, how about our airtime, right? Because we should tell people that we're not live. We've probably just been introduced, and we're recording about 2 hours early, well, just so we can be here.
Technically, either you're joining us listening to the pre-recorded show on Stony Brook, or you're listening live via Hope's website.
That's true.
I believe it's radio.statler.net, and then there's a listen link that you can tune into the show live.
If only we could tell our Stony Brook listeners how to listen live.
Yeah, you can listen live to us all other times at WUSB.FM, WUSB.org.
But by the time they heard this, it'll be too late to tune in live for now.
Yeah, don't call in if you're at Stony Brook right now. Or you can, but no one will answer.
So, Dakami.
It's all this time machine that travel that hasn't been invented yet.
Yeah. So, Dakami, you've been able to check out stuff the most, along with Jonathan. What have you seen?
There are a bunch of interesting talks. Probably one of the better ones I've seen was some of the cold loop. Basically, I've primarily gone to the security talks and things like the cold loop attacks, which have been recently announced. But this was actually some live research demonstrated. Then there were some talks about the OpenSSL exploits on Debian. Things about FOIA requests, you know, back. There's a lot of these topics we should probably go over, you know, a little bit further into the show.
Are you are you planning on catching the XSS cross-site scripting exploit? Or
I wasn't aware of this.
I have a friend, I think, speaking on that. I think that's today at some point. But I mean, the problem with this this conference is sometimes there's so much good stuff going on that you can't actually catch every talk you want to see.
Right. There are four concurrent scheduled tracks.
Four?
Three concurrent scheduled tracks and one unscheduled track.
Yeah, the sixth floor, there's some randomness going on occasionally.
On the sixth floor?
Yeah.
I totally missed the sixth
floor. No, it's on the 18th, I thought.
Well, there's mezzanine, where we are right now, on the 18th, and then there's sixth floor. If you look in the back of your Hope guidebooks, are just unscheduled, one-off.
Oh, that's where fourth track is?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
What do we think Stony Brook listeners know about Hope? Already. Do they know? Do Stony Brook listeners know anything about Hope?
I would assume so.
Do they know what it stands for?
Hope stands for Hackers on Planet Earth. It's a conference run by the 2600 magazine that's actually broadcast out of Stony Brook most of the time.
Right, and this is held every 2 years, I think?
Yep.
And this one, is it really going to be the last Hope?
The rumor is that it's the last Hope because this building is now owned by a real estate company called Vornado.
That has actually been solved, and the building will probably stay.
Yeah.
But even if it does, there's lots of other problems
with holding a conference.
With Hope. One of us is the actual size of the conference. Over the years, it's grown and grown. And walking around today, like if you go into some of the panels, there are so many people, it's almost impossible to find a seat. People are, like, lining up against the walls. Everyone's really interested.
Right, but it's standing room only. It's really overcrowded.
I got to say, from past experience, that every Hope I've been to, I've been to the last two ones, it's always been like that, especially Saturday.
But the difference is, on, like, Friday morning, or even today, I guess I got here around 10 o'clock, which is not a regular rising time for most hacker types. And it was already, some of the talks were already full.
Yeah. Even the overflow room where basically they have someone controlling a live feed of one of the four talks was full. Like during the Rambam talk, all the hammocks were full and there was a ton of people standing
in. You say hammocks, can you elaborate a bit?
Hammocks, yeah. I mean, geeks, you know, aren't used to walking around and doing this much physical activity at once.
Walking?
Yes, yeah, walking.
Right.
So they set up a bunch of hammocks near a giant projector close to all the sellers' booths, and you can hang out there and basically watch talks that you either can't get into upstairs or, like, think that you'll get winded on the elevator.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Some people don't realize this. And so they're sitting in uncomfortable positions up against the walls on the floor, on the 18th floor, while they could go downstairs and be laying down in a hammock and watching the... This is all the same content.
Guys, this is boring as hell. I don't want to hear about hammocks. Let's hear about tech.
This is all kind of part of the culture of the event. The culture of the convention.
I want to hear what you're seeing. What have you guys seen that's cool?
Rambam.
Lots of cool stuff.
Yeah?
I don't want to tell people about that.
Why not?
Keeping it all to myself.
Oh, because you don't want anybody to come in and crowd the place up more.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, don't go to Hope in two years. It's dead.
Do right after they listen to the show. Is jump in their car, drive to the city, the Hotel Pennsylvania, and there's still a day and almost a half
left. Because then, these things don't end at midnight, trust me.
Oh, there's after parties, there's to be.
Yeah, there's a couple cool after parties around here.
Halfway House is... If you're in Manhattan...
Oh, and Kupo is signaling that if we tell them about that, then we're going to be crowded out of
there. Then they're going to hunt you down and kill you, probably.
Well...
Okay, I'm going to toot my own horn a little bit because I've been working on one of the cooler projects for the last couple of days. Most people that have pre-registered for Hope have shown up and received a RFID badge.
Very cool.
Hold it up to the mic for them.
Okay, there you go. Can you guys hear the 2.4 gigahertz spectrum over the airwaves?
As well as the blinking LED.
Right.
And what these do are allow the... We spent all Thursday night during setup putting up tons of readers on the second mezzanine floor. And these readers are the same readers that were designed by the Triple C out in Germany for their conferences. And what we're doing in real time is tracking all of our conference attendees. Well, not all of them, but about 1,400 of them. And while they're being tracked, they've also filled out profiles describing their likes, dislikes, where they're from generally. We're data mining it in real time.
There's this interesting graph, and I think it's on the website, right? Where you can see how many people are in which conference room.
That we got up early early this morning. We got up a visualization that actually allows you to see where all the badges are on the second floor. And the badges, I don't know if many of you know this, at the conference have a button on them. When you touch the button, it will glow blue on the map for a couple of seconds, pretty neat.
Yep.
But that website is no longer available external to the conference. Okay. Last night, it got pounded after it got slashdotted, and tons of people all over the world started accessing the internal badge website and crashed it, which was cool.
Uh-huh.
I mean, better than nobody.
Do you know what's going to happen with all of this data? Is it going to be pushed out for public use? Because I can see some interesting application that people can do, maybe tracking how people move around. And
So to answer your first question, yes.
Okay.
To answer your second question, no comment.
Okay, excellent.
So lots of cool stuff, though. Let's see, these RFID tags, they're the badges for the event, right? So everybody's walking around proudly displaying their RFID tags.
Yeah, it's a slight allusion to what's going on right now in the real world with the U.S. passports and the Real ID Act and RFID basically being casually rolled out to a lot of stuff and seen as almost a prestige symbol. And so we kind of wanted to make a commentary on that. And we also, it's cool tech. I mean, it's a tool, like any other tool. It can be used for good, it can be used for bad.
Right.
But I mean, it's cool.
And what this ties into is, I think, a featured speaker, Stephen Rambam.
Yeah.
The title of his talk is something like "Privacy is Dead, Get Over It."
Yeah, I believe he's still going right now, 3 hours strong. Yeah,
right. And so he's basically telling you, if you call up somebody with your cell phone and caller ID comes up, he can pretty much run you down, get all this kinds of information about you, web browsing, where you tend to browse websites, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Basically, just from your phone number, and he doesn't have to leave his office. It doesn't take him much time. And he also said things like CIA, FBI, they don't bother doing their own footwork on this stuff. They just basically outsource everything to commercial information miners.
And I think the biggest point to take away from his talk is a lot of this is voluntary and done by the people themselves. They put all the information on Facebook, MySpace, and whatnot.
Yeah.
And you can track on Twitter, and you can track people who voluntarily put this information online. And it's just become, a huge data mine for private private investigators like right. Stephen
Rambo. And there are people whose job it is essentially to put this information together, to find the information that you put on the internet, tie it back to your identity, so that when somebody calls up and says, what can you tell me about so-and-so?
Such and such a person, or what mm-hmm. can you tell me about this IP, or what can you tell me about this phone number, and it's exactly. all linked together.
All linked together.
So
right.
so there are people out there whose job is summarizers?
And from right, and
they're
from this information,
yeah.
they don't just know stuff about you, but they create associations. You know this person, you yeah. know that person. These two people shared an address, shared a phone number at one time or another.
Yeah. So really? the only final step to actually making that flawless is that the software is not good enough yet at associating these disparate databases.
Well, according to him, the details are there, and you know, competent people who are doing it, which is apparently why the government agencies are outsourcing. Apparently, they're just not really good at this, or they have legal restrictions which don't apply if they just go out and buy information.
Yeah.
In security, there is this concept of forward security. So even though they might not be able to link all this information today, the fact is storage is so cheap.
Yeah.
And even though it's not linked in today, it will be tomorrow. So it doesn't matter whether the software is here or not, because the storage is so cheap.
And that note, he actually mentioned something about British Telecom or something scanning a whole bunch of phone books that they had, like almost going 100 years back. So all of a sudden,
really?
You could look up what somebody's phone number was 100 years ago.
That's
creepy.
Yeah. And it's going to be more and more the norm every single day that we live.
So all this information that was previously, you know, safely hidden, buried in old filing cabinets.
Let's not kid ourselves. It wasn't hidden. It was obscured.
Obscured, exactly.
It was hard to find.
Yeah, it was the bottom of a locked filing cabinet, you know, in a dark room, like, you know, no lights.
It wasn't an easily searchable Excel file.
In the past, this information has primarily been most of the information has been collected by authorities. So, you know, all the three-letter agencies. But today, most of the information is in private hands. So it kind of flips that balance a bit, too. There was an interesting talk yesterday on the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act.
Yep.
And it really dove into all the ways of, gathering the information that the government is holding. And the question came up of, is it possible to access the information? So the government is outsourcing some of the data storage. And so if it is it possible to file a FOIA request to get that information?
Of course not.
Well actually, yeah. I forgot who the speaker was for that, but he basically showed every single way that he learned through trial and error how to get your FOIA records and what we can neither confirm nor deny that there are any documents relating to this, what that means, and basically explained in really thorough detail their system. And actually, a lot of their system, anything before 1972, I believe, is still not searchable. It's not digitized. It is all on paper.
Yeah.
And unless you specifically request to search the non-index database, you will probably get a no records found.
Mm-hmm.
You will certainly get it if you request anything that happened pre-1972, and then you're allowed to just send another letter saying, well, can I request that you also search that database. So basically, he's a historian, and you can find these records. And the outsourcing to the records aren't exactly, they're not like out of country. There's 57 offices right now in the United States that are field offices.
FBI field offices.
FBI field offices. These are for FBI records, and they can and will, you know, blot out names and edit the documents before they send it to you, depending on how classified the information is. But there are 57 field offices, so if a document's in one of the field offices and not in the central office, or you send a request to a specific field office but there's a related document in another, they're not all networked together. They're trying to centralize, but the outsourcing isn't... it's mostly in the footwork. It's not in the actual data. The data is still in the U.S. and still...
Well, the outsourcing term is a very widely used term. I mean, the... definition of it varies broadly, so one, it could be interpreted.
One might argue that the whole reason they are utilizing outsourcing is that they don't have to, those outsourcing companies don't have to
They don't have the same legal restrictions,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. They don't have to comply with a Freedom of Information Act.
Yep.
The CA can go, we've got nothing on you. And they don't. The outsourcing company does. When they need something, they contact the company. If they have an ongoing case. I don't know if that falls under the jurisdiction of a Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, in the past talks that Stephen Rambam has given, he's made this point that the federal agencies are turning to private enterprise to help them with all this information because they're able to provide services faster, better, and with fewer restrictions.
And fewer legal consequences.
With some legal consequences.
I mean, in a sense, it's almost very similar to what's going on with Blackwater. The contractor for the U.S. military. It's the same thing. They wipe their hands of any responsibility once they turn over any assignments to that company.
Well, I don't think the data miners are killing people, but...
What's that?
I don't think the data miners are doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah, but who's to say that the data miners aren't incriminating certain people that are then retired by those three-letter agencies, but I don't know if you want to veer into that conversation.
Interesting.
And by the way, the name of the FOIA presenter is Phil Lapsley. And we should probably mention that a lot of these talks are going to be available through 2600. So if you weren't able to get out here and listen to these, and maybe you're somewhat intrigued by from our discussion here, in the future you'll be able to get access to it.
I know traditionally every year they will compile a DVD. After Hope is done with, I mean, I think last year, 2 years ago, it was a 6 DVD set, covered everything. And this year, I think they're even doing a better job.
And it's actually kind of interesting. If you're here, then you can come out of a talk, and if you liked it, you can get a DVD right then and there, maybe five or ten minutes later, pick it up. And, you know, you have an archival copy that if you want to, you know, show someone or go over it again. It's quite interesting. I haven't really seen that done at all. And many other conferences.
Right. I was just informed that they're going to also be streaming for a week these talks. So I guess if you hit hope.net, you'll be able to find a link to some of the streams for, I guess, virtually all the talks they've taped here.
Wow, that's really
cool. Do you know
really
if cool. that's audio only or with the video?
Bill, can you comment? Is it audio only or video?
Audio only, video.
Okay, so it's mostly the audio of the talks and the video for later.
For sale later, right?
Oh, it'll be for sale on the DVDs.
Right.
Okay.
So what's
what other talks did you like?
Let's say the tables here. What do you think is the coolest thing? If we're only going to talk about one thing, what would be the coolest?
No one's really shown much about the art installations that are here. We have the infamous dildo flowers over by the escalators.
Right.
That had to be moved upstairs after hotel management got a little upset about that.
Right.
It was just moved?
It was moved on Thursday night after setup.
You think that's really a candidate for the coolest thing here?
No, that was the start of my cool... Okay. The cool artwork is... there's an LCD out there that controls... You can control spinning cubes with your hands based on ultrasonic...
Right, that's the...
Well, we have to argue that probably some of the coolest artwork here was yesterday at night where they did, a special concert.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe Jonathan...
Digital Life. If you go to Create... Digital Music. I don't know. I'm not affiliated with them, but can I plug other organizations?
Correct. Yeah, you're allowed to plug.
Okay.
Don't worry.
So, Create Digital Music is a print and online blog magazine, and they sponsored a little show last night from 11 to 2 of experimental music, and a lot of it involving audio-visual stuff, a lot of circuit bending, a lot of taking old Nintendos and using those as visualization, movie splicing. Some of it was really awesome, but it was funny because it was in the hammock area where everyone, some people were trying to sort of bum a free room to sleep, and it was at 1 in the morning with some very, very jarring sounds and music, just like no matter what, they couldn't fall asleep.
Perfect.
I saw people taking their backpacks and putting it on over their heads. It just didn't work out. You can see some samples. They're good.
We should consider those people to be part of the whole performance art, really.
The hippies, yeah. we had a huge discussion about... actually, there's a lot of talk about hippies in another talk, creating a... basically a hacker space. So like New York City Resistor, I like that. But
what is hackerspace?
So a hackerspace is really, it's basically, it's not a private area like a home or a completely public area like a school, but it's something in between where it fosters the creation of stuff, really.
Yeah, is either that like a place with a whole bunch of soldering irons?
Yeah, yeah. Well, all right. So there's a lot of different ones, but yeah, you definitely want a main table that has soldering that you can ground
yourself.
I noticed
that right away. You come up the escalator into the mezzanine level, and you see this internally illuminated quote-unquote artwork, and then you see tables full of soldering irons, and there are people hanging out and using soldering irons.
Oh, yeah. The trip glasses, what is it, the Brain Machine by Mitch, is a very popular item that you can purchase kits by him, and they make you hallucinate with sights and sounds.
There's all kinds of kits here, right?
I haven't seen Brain Machines, honestly, since my only two great days, but the idea behind them is you're supposed to sync up your brainwave patterns by utilizing various...
Alphas and betas, it tries to...
Causes a small seizure or something like that?
No.
No?
Not how they're supposed to.
It can. But they also have like an entire table of toys, a lot of different toys, sound makers right next to it, and you can just take anything you want and just sort of circuit bend things. I tried my first time and
so do our listeners know what circuit bending is?
It's what it sounds like. You're literally bending the circuits on the boards or otherwise
messing with a circuit board and then putting wires on it and getting an audio feed, right?
Yeah, so like the biggest circuit bend item is the Speak and Spell, and the easiest thing to do is to make the sounds lower their pitches to sound like growling noises or raise them really high to sound like a synthesizer. It's just messing with old junk to make old toys.
Is that sort of cheating, starting with a device that's intended to make sounds?
Like a guitar?
They do things with like pocket calculators, right?
Yeah.
And
it's
just all kinds of weird things.
Anything. It does not have to be audio related at all. It could be a motorboat, right? And you could just mic up the motor and then mess with the motor speeds, and that's like circuit bending. It's just making audio.
And this is just
out of
like
anything.
What you see walking in the door.
Tons of people, way more than you'd imagine. These tables filled up early and are quick, and it's hard to find seats. I actually had to go to another area to do my little Arduino hacking stuff.
Right. There's got to be like 20, 30 soldering irons out there, right?
Yeah, and I haven't seen anyone gotten burned. I have seen people break chairs in that area and almost got burned, but so far no one's been like rushed to the hospital yet. I don't know, maybe there's some behind-the-scenes stuff I haven't seen.
So these hackers kind of know what they're doing then?
No. A lot of them have no idea. I sat down at a table and I'm like, "What do I do?" And they're like,
you're like, "Okay,
open it up and press stuff."
That's the hot end, and this is the handle that you.
Yeah.
Can, okay, go to it.
This place is about expanding your horizons if you're a coder going to hardware.
On the other table here is the infamous organization Tool. T O O L. Which is
T O O O L.
Sorry. Yes.
Oh, it's 3 O's.
3 O's.
Don't ask me what the 3 O's are for.
It's the organization something of lockpicking.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's a group of hackers, but in this case, they don't actually hack computers. They go out and study locks, lockpicking, and all kinds of other technologies of basically finding vulnerabilities in security devices. And here they have a table where you can sit down, and they have a lockpick set and lots of locks laying on the table, so you can go ahead and practice actual lockpicking.
Yeah, and they sell lockpick kits, right?
Yeah, and I believe at Hope, they're engraved Hope, Last Hope.
Oh, that's really cool. You know what else is cool?
What?
Kevin Mitnick is here at Hope. Hopefully I didn't, tip off somebody who's going to come and try to arrest him or anything.
No, I think they had him for long enough.
All right. So,
after ghetto jail.
I wonder if he's wearing
the RFID
lockpick tag.
Kits that are engraved with his name on them. So you can get those, too.
I guess he's not finding much work as a security consultant, then.
I don't know.
Well, actually, there was a little bit of a presentation from the Make Magazine people, and they kind of briefly went over the project where they have in New York City basically a public laser engraver where you come into this room and you can put down whatever device you want. Primarily people do it with laptops, and you can basically choose a logo and it will be engraved onto your device. So it's kind of a neat thing. One of these
inexpensively
machines is,
too.
Yeah, this very machine is probably $20,000 or something like that. Yeah. And here I recommend for a few dollars get something engraved. And I heard that the project was so popular that they paid off for the machine in like a matter of months.
Yeah, they actually got a lot of emails and phone calls saying, "Oh, can I send you my laptop and you engrave it and send it back?" And they didn't want to deal with that, so they basically said, "Oh, well, here, we're going to publish a really easy way to start up a community." It was community engraving, but now it's expanded out to community fabrication.
What can this machine do? What can it engrave? Anything?
I know it. So the most popular item and the one that's always demoed is a MacBook Pro. The most popular item, and it just engraves right on the back of that. I've yet to see it engrave on something plastic. I'd like to get my IBM done up with something.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not sure how low power they go. But if you have like a tough piece of metal, it'll work on that.
Wow, that'll do metal.
Yeah, I mean, like, basically, yeah, so it got really popular.
I think the lockpick kits are not just laser engraved. They're thin sheets of aluminum, right?
Yep.
But they also use
I think
lasers.
They're steel. They're not aluminum.
Kevin Mitnick's are aluminum.
Aluminum, really?
According to Kevin Mitnick.
Huh, okay.
And I don't think he's selling them here. I think he's giving them out.
Oh, I guess I have to retract my comment about Kevin Mitnick consulting.
A lot of cool things, and I think they burn straight through the aluminum with the laser.
Wow.
It's the part of the fabrication process, not just the engraving.
Now, we should probably mention that there's some legal restrictions in a lot
in
of
New
regions.
Well, these lockpick kits are purely for ornamental reasons. They're actually not...
Well, you could pick your own locks with them.
No, you couldn't, because that would be illegal in New York.
Yeah,
to
really?
Own a lockpick set with the intent of... but you could own a replica lockpicking set purely for artistic purposes.
Right.
Commemorative.
Well, you know, I wouldn't want to degrade the value of the Kevin Mitnick lockpick set by actually removing the picks from the set.
Always get them still in the card.
Right, huh? Yeah. You, it's like a business card, and it's actually pretty cool.
Okay, cool. I know, Jonathan, you got to see something that everybody in the open source community has been really talking about lately, the OpenMoco phone, the Freerunner.
Oh, yeah.
How was that?
It was a lot better than I expected. So my biggest concern, and if anyone who's in marketing for OpenMoco hears this, they need to have bigger hand models. Because when I saw the pictures, it looked like it was a ginormous
device. It looks pretty fugly,
huge,
yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah?
It's slightly bigger than
very small hands demonstrating the product.
Yeah, that's what it's. I was worried that it was huge and that it wouldn't be. It would be unwieldy as this multi-purpose device, and also that the ring area wouldn't be that useful.
What area?
Well, so there's
on
like
the top.
Yeah, there's that curve with the space in the middle. It's much more rugged than it looks. So I would actually equip it to like a carabiner and be totally okay with that.
Really?
Because it's rubberized and the screen is tough.
Huh.
It's not as responsive as I like it to be, but there are two firmwares on it. And the person who let me borrow it, they were using this experimental firmware that had all these great features, but a lot of them were not completely fully working.
They weren't stable,
or
yeah.
Had, you know,
it's
in
funny because when the OpenMoco project started, who would have anticipated now that there's already multiple firmwares?
Right,
I believe one
right.
of them's the Trolltech firmware, one of them's the OpenMoco firmware, and of course Android will be able to run on that phone as well.
No, there's a huge controversy. Basically, this is why Sun was like yelling at Google for the longest time. So theoretically, when you write Java code, it can run on anything that has a virtual machine.
Yes.
And theoretically, the Android SDK is completely open source and it wouldn't need its own VM. But Google bundled a ARM-compiled VM that is the only one that works with Android or the SDK. I'm sure there are hackers trying to get around that, but you cannot, according to this person who owns it, owns the FreeRunner, you will not be able to run the Android operating system on anything other than that architecture, which is really, really disappointing.
That's really, really strange. What I'm basically hearing is that Google, I remember when Google wrote their own JVM instead of going with Suns.
Yeah.
But so Google's lockdown on the unit is not through hardware or anything else, but through their own JVM.
That's what it seems like. I don't know if it's a complete lockdown. I don't know if there's checks in the OS to see which VM you're using, and that, you know, it's theoretically possible that someone can extend the now fully open Java SDK to incorporate the functionality that the OS needs, but it is it was surprising for me to hear that, because I said the same exact thing. I'm like, oh, and have you tried Android on it? And the guy's like, nope, you can't do that. So, but the phone itself, the hardware is great.
Yeah,
and
hopefully, just at least by the nature of open source, the needed features will migrate from.
I'm thinking so.
Yeah.
Hope the whole idea behind Android, and you guys have known in past shows, I'm in love with the Android project. Although maybe this tanks my view a little bit.
Is to run on multiple platforms.
Yeah,
right?
you write code once and that's it. Yeah. Right. But at least the code's still open source and can be migrated back.
Yeah, that took off the rosy red glasses. That
they needed to come off sooner or later. I mean, Google is a business still after all, so I have to grow up.
So the open microphone is actually shipping now also. So if you do want to buy it, it's been on sale since the 7th of the month, I think. Or no, was it even the 4th of July?
The 4th is when they were taking orders, and since that was, I think that was a Friday, it was like things were going to start shipping on that Monday.
So cool. Yeah, this became available, I think, a lot earlier than what people were expecting.
Early July?
I think right here at the con, I was hearing from somebody saying they were thinking they were going to buy their last Palm OS device before migrating over to an OpenMoco kind of thing. And, hey, it's here already, although maybe it's not 100% ready.
I believe that the next revision is going to be completely open. I believe there's one piece of hardware in the current FreeRunner.
The GPS module they switched, which is weird. The first module had already support in the kernel, and now they switched to a better-performing module that was closed. But there's a couple of hardware things that they can fix, but again, you can just look at the entire schematics, propose something new, show it to them. I mean, they'll implement it. People were talking about, oh, well, you support CDMA. And they're like, no, as a matter of principle, we won't, because all CDMA and networks have all these restrictions we don't agree with.
Well, I believe the majority of CDMA network technology is owned by Qualcomm.
But even, I don't think they were that adamant about it. I think they just didn't like that Verizon and other carriers that I can't remember now, Sprint.
Sprint and Verizon are the only two CDMAs left in the U.S.
Yeah, so they started to be more open-friendly. They started to announce new initiatives that will support either GSM networks or just any hardware, any software, was something that Verizon announced. So they're like, once we heard that announcement, the next revision, it's very possible to have
excellent.
CDMA.
Great. So I am a Sprint customer, and I would love to be able to grab and stop getting yelled at every Lilac meeting for using a Windows mobile phone.
Yeah. The screen resolution's nice, too. Better than I expected. I was happy to play around with it.
So you mentioned earlier that you didn't like the actual outside of the plastic case. Well, the thing is, the CAD drawings are available, so you could theoretically change the outside look of the phone, send it to a manufacturer, and have enclosure for your phone.
I mean, if you were here, you could probably spend about 4 minutes looking for someone who has some community fabrication device to fabricate a aluminum case replacement casing, and then go to the community the etching device, and then have it etched for,
So you're saying we should have these every couple of months, basically?
Yes.
We should change Hope into just like we have free markets over in New York City on Union Square and stuff, farmers markets. We should have hacker marts every couple of months.
Oh, yeah. Walking down, they have, I don't know what the name of the booth is around here, with all this old archaic equipment that they just have, like, little people running around New York grabbing anything that has a little bit of lead in it and a little bit of plastic and just bringing it to here. I mean, huh. I've seen hardware I've never seen before.
I saw my Speak and Spell from my childhood, which I thought was pretty awesome. Yeah.
I saw an Osborne. Does anybody know what an Osborne 1?
No, you're dating yourself, Bill. Yeah, what's an Osborne 1?
There's an organization here called MARCH. Does anybody know what that stands for?
Oh.
So it's like archaic computing hobby something. I don't know.
Mid-Atlantic. I think it's Mid-Atlantic. Retro computing?
Retro computing. Okay. Mid-Atlantic retro computing something.
Yeah.
They had a working Osborne 1 here. It was amazing. Super flashback.
Lots of EPCs, too. A lot of people who came out here bought EPCs yesterday and today. Out of the five owners I talked to.
Yeah? Are they selling it here?
No, but they're, like, on this block. You can go down to J&R, you can go down to a bunch of places, and they're selling all the models from the 700 to the 901. I don't think the 904 and 5 are out yet, but that's what I've seen at the conference. I saw two OLPCs.
Uh-huh.
Probably their first opportunity to make a mesh network ever.
I don't know. I mean,
well, you get a couple of Lilog once in a while, but...
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, but, I mean, they could just get up and walk over and say hi to each other at that point, so... But this might be actually viable. I wonder if you could go from the mezzanine up to the 18th floor here with two OLPCs.
Doubt it. I mean, it's not with that much cement in between them.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting. It'd be interesting.
It depends on if the antennas are directional. I wonder a little bit about radio stuff. Ilya, were you there? .commy, were you there for the off the grid talk? Where?
Yes. I was there for part of the talk. What was actually that? Very interesting. It concerned with technologies dealing with communication that don't rely on the internet. Primarily, this to some extent, the talk was aimed towards activist groups that might have a reason to try to, for example, working in a nation which heavily restricts the communication. So instead, you could probably use some kind of other radio technologies to talk back and forth, either to organize an event, an activist event, and things of this sort. It was really interesting.
What sort of techniques did they suggest?
Well, they primarily went over stuff you can buy. And there's a lot of new technologies coming out, including the encrypted, basically walkie-talkie type devices, VHF and UHF radios, are now becoming available at a reasonable price where the end consumer, who's not part of a large organization, can actually buy these and use them within their ad hoc organization.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea is that they didn't want to use anyone else's infrastructure. Hmm. Since it was like an introductory talk, they went with very simple one-to-one.
Anything but Ethernet? Was that the...
No, it's not even any infrastructure. You don't even want to... You want it to be, like, point-to-point, pad-encrypted, you know, maybe with repeaters. And if you get really fancy, you can use a reflector to repeat. I don't recall all the terminology, but basically, you're either...
A parabolic dish kind of thing, or...?
Well, just saying that you have, like, five or six people listening, and you broadcast to this one... repeater that all these people are listening
right,
to.
Okay. Is this like ham radio operator licensed kind of stuff, or is this something else completely?
This encompasses that, but it goes a little bit broader, including other technologies. I think it's mainly primarily, or to some extent, meant for the heavily regulated countries where you want to do communications, but can't for legal reasons.
Like most of them.
Communications. Telefreak is here.
Oh, right? So we want to go into that.
Well, it's just kind of cool that people can show up and, on a few minutes' notice, they can build a PBX, right?
I did not. I saw Telefreak, and I saw the two phones that they had hooked up.
They had a couple pay phones out there. They've got these analog telephone adapters, so you can pick up a pay phone. You can pick up an
phone
with a rotary dial.
Yes.
And you can dial 9, and you get into the menu system on their PBX.
Yes.
And then it tells you about how, you know, they... We built this PBX in about a half an hour at 3 in the morning on a Thursday before the...
Yeah.
And if you dial this number, you can join the conference of all the other people on our payphones.
Which I believe is tied into not only the conference itself, but other people from around the world that are VoIPing in and Skyping in and free world dial-upping into these PBXs because it's all VoIP.
And I hear that if you actually put a quarter in the payphone, it gets donated to some charity.
Oh, that's awesome. That is so cool.
We saw
it doesn't do anything. You get a dial tone either way, but if you put a quarter in, it gets donated to some charity.
It'd be great if it said, thank you for donating to blah, blah, blah.
It's free
anyway.
Right.
Me and Dotcommy saw Lady Ada, a video on her putting together... She's from Make. She basically procured a payphone, hacked up 3 separate microcontrollers on PCBs to have it work with her local VoIP and require coins, put the coins in a cup, and after like maybe 8 or 9 hours of like intense soldering and testing and programming to make all the switches and the mechanics work exactly like a regular payphone, spent another hour and a half creating a box to a tone dialer, replacing this circuitry on a tone dialer, I think the crystal, so that she can hack out of her own payphone.
In other words, blue box the payphone. So it's really, she spent all this time making the phones explicitly work off coins, where it's a lot easier to just make them work without coinage and have a whole coin counter
That's
built in, and then built all the other stuff
a whole billing system into her phone so that she could then circumvent the billing system in her phone.
It was actually even missing the mechanical coin counter on the inside, and she replaced it with her own that was just with like basic microcontrollers.
Interesting.
And all this stuff, even if it's, I mean, all of it's open, you hear any name or any idea or any organization that we're talking about and you look it up, all of these projects are documented better than ever before. The documentation used to be the worst part of all these things, and now people are much more organized.
You get nice images. I saw a couple of people at the soldering tables going to websites. They had a kit in front of them, and they had pictures of that kit.
That's great.
Yeah.
Like,
step by step.
I'll solder here.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other interesting things going on. People making their own stuff. There's a guy from James and Sears with something that he calls the Orb. I call it a globe,
right?
It's that spinning thing.
Yeah, it's a whole bunch of FGPAs mounted on a circular board, and around the rim of the board, I believe, are LEDs.
Right.
And then the board spins in 2 axes. The entire globe spins, and the circle itself spins.
What?
Oh. No, is it just the board spins?
Just the board spins.
I think they have 2. The globe.
They've got a second one that has more stuff going on like that.
Okay.
That's true.
Yeah. And basically because of persistence of vision, the LCDs the LEDs change very rapidly, and I think they have it just on the stock Earth.
The one that's only rotating around a vertical whatever.
Yeah.
That one is mostly just displaying a map of the country.
And
that's pretty cool. Map of the entire globe.
Yes.
And that's pretty cool by itself. And that one's not... The reason why you look at it and it's, like, not all the FPGAs are on the board. There's obviously places where more components go.
Yeah.
It's not complete.
Ah.
And so you're seeing, like, some parts of the globe or the color, certain colors stand out and others don't. It's like, well, they haven't put everything in to make those lights light up yet.
Yeah.
So it's like less than half complete, and it's still really cool looking.
Yeah, it's very cool, very impressive looking when you watch it.
But have you guys seen the display with the three-dimensional...
The strings?
The volumetric strings. Yes.
They call that the WireMap 3D volume renderer, and Albert Huang is here. He calls himself FedEx, and you could look at his stuff at FedEx, P-H-E-D-E-X, I think .com, maybe it's a .org.
Okay.
But there's a FedEx thing. And
all this information you're reading off is obviously all available on hope.net. All the talks are listed there as well.
I have no idea. I just walked around and asked people questions.
Yeah.
And I thought he should be talking to the guy on the other side of the room that has these. He's got a flat panel display.
Yes.
It's just lying flat on a table. And he's got these cubes, like four or six, maybe just four cubes.
They're almost like large dice displayed on the screen.
And then he's got acoustic proximity sensors.
Yeah.
So as you walk by the thing, it's kind of like the stuff in the mall where they're projecting images on the floor and the kids like stomp on the bugs
and stuff like this. And there's an infrared camera that interacts.
But this is acoustic proximity sensors, so that as you walk by, it's as if you're brushing past the thing and the cubes spin on the display.
And the purpose of that game, he told us, was to eventually stop the cubes from spinning. Uh-huh. If you put your hands and kind of control
tricky.
The rotation.
Right,
yeah.
It's oversensitive and it's tough to get the cubes.
Yeah.
To balance and I just thought, wow, and there's this other guy doing this cube rendering and sphere renderings in 3D, and wouldn't it be cool to put these things together, right?
Yeah.
So you could walk by the box, the wire map of vertical strings, and have the sphere react to your presence. And what else? There's the guy with the laser pointer.
Graffiti Research Labs has a presence here.
I didn't even see that. I know that they were going to be here, but I haven't seen it yet. Where is it?
It's on the far
here.
Wall.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Right next to the orb. You could take a Segway there from where we're standing.
Okay.
Well, one of them's out of commission. We actually we saw a crash.
Oh, my God. I've seen so many Segway crashes.
Yeah.
This sound booth that we're in has been crashed into several times. And
Still standing, though.
It's got nice styrofoam bits that fly off in dramatic fashion whenever a Segway runs into it. We have... Okay. But the laser pointer thing is very cool.
Yeah, I definitely want to play with the laser pointer. I remember watching YouTube videos of it, and they were painting buildings from about 100 feet off.
Really?
Yeah, at night.
At night. Yeah, yeah. That must be really dramatic. But he's got a video projector... And then a camera right next to the video projector, and they've got them aligned somehow so that you can use a green, or what they're using is a green laser pointer to point at the screen, and you can paint on the screen like with a mouse.
Yeah.
So in schools, they've got these smart boards, and those are, I think, really expensive devices. I'm wondering if you could do this without a touch-sensitive board, right?
What?
Smart boards in schools nowadays, have you seen those?
Yeah.
So you just have to have some other feedback display about how to get the information from the laser, where the laser's drawing onto the board.
I think they're using a camera for that.
Right, exactly.
Is that what it is?
Yep,
yeah.
They've got a camera set up right
cameras,
next to their video projector. So it can sense where the green laser is pointing.
So then, you could do it on a smart board easy.
Right.
Easier.
The way they've got it set up right now, they've got a custom application that just lets you do paint. But I imagine that you could work something out pretty easily that would turn it into a mouse pointer. Right? On a screen?
Yeah.
And work any application with a laser pointer? That'd be cool.
Yeah.
From 300 feet away?
From 300 feet away. On the side of a building.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how big your class is, just hold them all at night.
They actually had the cops stop them when they were first trying it out on one of the buildings and joined in because it was completely non-destructive. There was,
you know, what are you doing to that building?
Yeah. They actually, like, there was nothing they were doing that was illegal. Or permanent, really, besides, like, the video archival. So the cops just sort of called over their friends. You might see it in the video just to play around with that.
Yeah, if you Google Graffiti Research Lab.
Labs, yeah.
Yeah, labs. You'll definitely find a lot of these really cool videos that they've put out about some of their project. Or throwies.
They did the lead throwies.
Which were aired during the previous host.
And are here now.
I thought that was something that was in Make Magazine.
Well, it was featured in Make.
And Make Magazine has a table here, right?
Yes.
As well as No Starch Press. There's a lot of tables here.
They're very popular tables.
Right.
Make sold, well, they didn't sell out, but they sold out of the really good items.
And the Free Software Foundation has a table here.
Yeah, it's true.
EFF.
DIFR, which we've mentioned on the air before.
What are they?
They've got the RFID-proof wallets and stuff.
Ah, yeah.
So I'm thinking about actually buying a wallet. I haven't had one for quite a while.
Yeah, now that you... is this in reaction to the project here at Hope, or...?
No. I just, you know... I just haven't had a wallet for so long. I've been waiting for just the right thing, and I think this might be it.
It's good.
Yeah, they're actually better than a lot of the first RFID blocking wallets. If you open the wallet slightly, it would actually amplify the signal.
They had a proximity card here, right? There's some backscatter interference thing it does. If you hold a proximity card in front of a reader that's supposed to read it, and you take your wallet and you put it behind, not in between, behind the card, it interferes and it knocks out communication between the proximity card and the reader.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you actually have to take the thing out. It's a small distance, but you have to get it a small distance away from the wallet, which is totally passive, right? It's just leather or plastic with whatever kind of mesh they've got in it.
Yeah, I have no idea what materials they're using. I used to hear that, you know, it was basically you had lead or eel skin would interfere.
Eel skin?
I heard eel skin.
Interesting.
I don't know how true that was, but I heard
they're
eel skin.
They're using some kind of metal mesh, probably, as a Faraday cage.
Right, but there's also this backscatter interference thing, right? Where although it's passive, it's somehow interfering with the device, even though it's not in between the card and the reader. So.
Mm-hmm. I was pleasantly surprised actually with I'm not a big fan of security talks, but there is one that I went to, which was the OpenSSL debacle.
Oh yeah.
And it was a bunch of people from Debian, and they explained what's vulnerable, why it's vulnerable. It was basically a. Yeah, this is very well documented. If you want, you can search OpenSSL bug and vulnerability, and I think the actual tracker commit for the bug is like the first hit on Google. But
One thing that hasn't been talked about much about, but. One of the presenters who did a talk in this OpenSSL talk is also the developer of Tor, and so there was some issues with the Tor network, since it does rely on SSL for the underlying encryption, there was a potential for some vulnerabilities, and they were narrowly avoided in the actual master database of Tor servers. I think. There are there's a good number of those servers.
Six? There are six.
Yeah,
had the vulnerability.
And three had the vulnerability.
Really?
Now, there's one cool thing is Tor requires four servers to provide it with the list, and then it does a majority count. So even if someone did try to hijack, since there were only three vulnerable servers, they wouldn't be able to do that. Because of majority rules. And it's kind of interesting how these problems were narrowly avoided. And also, at the same time, unfortunately, there were issues that weren't widely discussed in the news or in blogs or whatever in relation to this security exploit or bug that were discussed at this talk. I guess every security-conscious person should probably... download and listen to this presentation. It was really interesting.
Yeah, they actually ended up using Amazon's cloud computing services to create a master list of all the vulnerable keys. And for $24 in a matter of 8 hours, when it would normally take like a regular computer 5 or 6 days, they had a list of every single vulnerable key.
Every common... Common vulnerable key.
Right, every common vulnerable key. I mean, most of these only affect defaults. If you change your defaults, it's trivial if you know what things were changed, like anything else in security. But for the most part, there were big websites that had certificates that could be spoofed. Like, there's a German banking website that was vulnerable for a while, and some U.S. ones, too. So having that kind of access,
and
showing that a hacker...
with the recent DNS vulnerability that was just patched.
Does anybody remember the article on the package management tools being the weakest link a couple of weeks ago?
Package management tools.
Management tools, apt and yum repositories. There was a research study done how people were easily able to set up a mirror, list themselves as a legitimate mirror, and have people start downloading packages from that mirror
as trusted signatures.
Yeah, it's trusted packages. And this was a huge...
Each package is signed by its maintainer.
It's signed by its maintainer?
Yeah.
I'm not sure the method they use, but they basically figured out a way to circumvent either the checking or...
They poisoned it somehow.
They provide their own root certificate and, you know...
Yeah. Well, he's talking about individual packages.
But I guess you can combine this with the DNS exploit, right? If you set up a fake mirror... and you hijack the DNS cache.
Well, I think it was actually a real mirror that was legitimized and got on the top mirror list.
But in this case, you don't even have to do that. You can use a lot less effort, and using the DNS exploit, you can use the same attack basically.
Yeah, there are a lot of vulnerabilities out there, huh? You could hijack just about anything, almost an entire state.
I think we're trying to be slick here and segue into a story that I wanted to cover. I don't know if we have enough radio time left, but I don't know if you guys have seen the headline about the San Francisco infrastructure that's been basically locked down this last week.
I've heard like bits and pieces about this. I guess some guy was kind of upset at...
Well, there's two sides to it, and the side that was publicly listed was that there was one guy, one CCIE, responsible for San Francisco's fiber WAN network. He configured and ran everything. Then they started instituting security audits. On their first security audit, they said, hey, this guy knows everything about the fiber WAN network, and no one else does.
Oops.
Yeah. And why don't we press him for details? They pressed him. They fired him because he didn't want to give up the details. And now they're suing him because he revoked everyone else's logins except for his own.
For sysadmin logins.
What's that?
For sysadmin-type logins.
For network switches, I believe. Just the network infrastructure.
Now, if he went in after the fact, after he was fired and made a change like that...
Yes.
That's not kosher.
Okay. So the other side of the story is he was so demanding and exacting of his network, and this doesn't legit diminish your point here because I agree grudgingly with it. That basically he didn't want to turn over control of the network to unexperienced network admins because it was so complicated and so specialized that he was afraid someone would mess it up. And this point is validated by the fact that I believe it's been a week or a week and a half, and the network is still running, even though he's not there. He's obviously in jail, and everyone else is locked out, but the network's still running flawlessly.
And I think they also noticed some changes being made to this network. I get there might be a third party involved on his behalf,
really?
Making some modifications and doing some control.
I hadn't read that, but that's interesting.
Of course, I don't have any confirming sources. It might have been just hearsay, but that
would be odd. That would be another thing. I mean, if he was really concerned about the security of that network, he wouldn't have given up control to anyone else, right?
I believe that's what just happened,
right.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think San Francisco is making the story sound a bit different.
The initial headline was from San Francisco's newspapers, and it basically, you know, tried, convicted, and hung this guy. And now I think that is being disputed a little bit because I don't think that's the whole story at this point.
Right, but the San Francisco side of the story, I mean, if San Francisco has got this big network, they should be able to hire some other network engineers and reconfig their network devices, right?
Yes.
I mean,
if you have physical access, you should be able to reset.
So maybe this guy's argument is good.
He's actually locked out the password resets as well on the units. I know that much from the article.
Right, apparently...
He's disabled password at resets.
I mean, it's still able to sort of reinitialize the entire network, but the amount of downtime is probably...
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
like, are they going to have to make JTAGs to flash the ROMs on these things?
That's what it might come down to, because I believe the legitimate way of, like, resetting the passwords on these machines is no longer usable.
I thought you had mentioned something where he just didn't... He had the configs for all these boxes loaded remotely.
In addition
to... the configs were not on the boxes.
Yeah,
therefore,
he wouldn't back up any of the flash configs.
The password was not in flash memory.
No, so cold boot attacks.
It's in some... Well, in theory, it would still be vulnerable to a cold boot attack.
I mean, over the top, like, solutions for something that should be resolved a little more, I think, one on one.
But still, if you just turn the machine off, it might not come back. Right?
Yeah. That's the risk right now with that where we're at in the case.
And I actually have the same problem at home, where I accidentally today screwed up my SSH server on my router, and now I can't log in. So, but I think we should wrap up the show. This is Ilya.
This is Bill.
This is Jonathan.